So I'll put the recording typically, if not the same day, then the next day. I'll make it available to you, so you can, if you cannot make it, you can always listen to what I said and also watch the slides. Just a handful of slides about the topic of this class. It's on purpose in the second semester. The purpose is that by now you have already observed some scientists in action. You have already done some work yourself, so hopefully these topics are going to be more interesting to you. They will be more meaningful. What topics? I'll tell more about that, and we'll also list the rest of the semester, the topic of every class, and what can you get out of that? And I do believe that you can get quite a lot. Actually, there's no need to justify English. We have to do it in English because of foreign students with us. English is the language of science. It has become that way. There used to be other languages in the past, German, French, in Soviet Union and satellites, they used a lot of Russian. But today, with the global science, English is the language. So you have to practice it, you have to learn how to talk in English, present your work, and also write in English. I will start with motivation. Why? What are we talking about? So I'll show you a few movies, very short clips. And what I want you to do is tell me about the common theme. What is unifying these short movies? We'll start with a short piece by... where are we? Here, I guess. Oops, not here. Sorry. Here we are. So, really a brief movie. We will not listen to the whole thing, but just a little bit. Another movie. It's a piece of a very good Taiwanese movie, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. I definitely recommend it, but it's just the opening sequence of that movie. Again, we will not watch the whole thing, just a few minutes. Thank you. Maybe that's enough. I recommend the whole movie, not just the opening sequence. So what's next? A handful of movies with martial arts. Let's see. Let me show you this one, maybe. So easy, almost like prepared, but of course they are prepared a little bit, but if those junior people didn't know how to fall, there would be blood on the scene, broken hands. It just looks so easy, but it's actually a lot of art. Let me just one last thing. This kendo, the same idea. That's it. Very good. So, what's the common theme of these movies? They are very, very different. Those of you who like cooking probably appreciated the motions, the movements of that cook. I don't think it was the actor's hands. They probably hired some professional, very, very good cook doing this. And then the martial arts. What's the common theme here?
High skills.
Pardon?
High skills.
Very high skills. These were all absolute experts, acknowledged and proven to be experts. Well, the cook, we don't know, but clearly the guy was, probably the guy, the hands were male. Very, very good. Universal language in the sense of they knew what they were doing. They were masters, right?
Like music is universal in every country. So music is
yes.
The same thing, right?
Humans are very, very similar in every country, every culture. There are minor differences. The length of hair, the color of your skin. These are all minor differences. I agree with that, absolutely. It's a universal thing. There was nobody... Well, Horowitz was brought up in Russia, grew up in Russia, I think, right? Horowitz. So, no Polish people, but the same idea. It doesn't matter what nationality was there. Arts. Yes, yes, you could say it. But it does, again, that's true, but it probably doesn't matter because I could have had mathematicians here or engineers, although it would be less spectacular to show their skills, right? Mathematician thinking and an engineer designing something. All of them were quite aged, if you noticed, but that they were all older. It doesn't really matter that much, but I guess it took them time to become that good, all of them.
I think also the common thing is precision. They are doing very precisely their things.
Perfectly.
Mastery in their fields.
Yes. If you look at masters, they do it very, very easily. Masters in anything. Masters in teaching. They do it like if they were getting things out of their sleeves easily, right? Those guys were also, the motions were perfect.
Easily and perfect at the same time.
Pardon?
I thought that easily and perfect
easily.
At the same time.
Yes. My intention here was to show the following. They are all very good at what they are doing. It took them many, many years to reach that skill, that precision. Another thing that is very common to them, which wasn't very clear in the movies, although those of you who know the disciplines probably will also see it. They learn from other people. Why did they learn from other people? Because the skills are so difficult to master on your own. I'll show you some of the examples, like Horowitz, his pedigree, from whom he learned. In martial arts, it's absolutely fundamental. You learn the martial art in a dojo, from a sensei, from a master. If you want to learn it yourself, your lifetime is not going to be enough for that. The master will tell you how to do it. This here is a picture from Star Wars. As you see, the master is training the apprentice. As a scientist, if you want to reach that level, perfection, if you want to be really very good at what you are doing, you are dealing with a difficult skill. There are a lot of things that you have to learn, that you have to master. If you don't master them, you will not do that well. Many skills. And of course you can learn it from books, but it's going to be slow. Humans are constructed in such a way that they learn the most from other humans. And that starts at a very, very young age. When you are a kid like this, you learn from your parents. Those, I don't see people who qualify for the following example. In the beginning, when you are young, a teenager, first your parents are, they know everything, and then you have this difficult period when you notice things in your parents that you don't like. In fact, sometimes you hate those things in your parents. And then at the age of 30-something, that's why I said I don't see anybody qualified here yet, you have an absolutely terrible experience. You realize, when dealing with your children, that you have learned from your parents things that you hated most in them. Has anybody had this experience? I had it. It's terrible. You know, I realized suddenly, boy, the things that I disliked in my parents, I'm doing that myself. No, I cannot do that. One thing, for example, I noticed when my oldest son was, I forgot how many, 3-4 years old, I was brushing teeth with him. Of course, you teach them by doing things. So when I brush my teeth, I put toothpaste on my brush and then put it under water to make it wet. And then I used to hit it a few times on the edge of the sink to get the excess water off. My son, he couldn't even reach there. He was like that. He was reaching like that to the sink to wet his brush. He was hitting it. I bet he didn't know why he was doing that. It was an incredible experience. I realized that I cannot pick my nose in front of my son because he will learn it too. Right? I realized he's learning from me more than I would like him to learn. The same with my doctoral advisor. I also learned things from him some things I wish I didn't learn, like doing things at the last moment. I somehow learned it from him. So anyway, we learn from other people, and it's a very, very strong thing. When you interact with your advisor, you learn a lot of things, even the things that you don't want to learn from them. And this is the easiest way to learn. If you want to do things on your own, you can do it. You are all very smart. But it will take you much, much longer. That's the first thing. That's why this master-apprentice model. If you want to learn how to make shoes, the old way was to work with a shoemaker. You look at the shoemaker, you repeat what the shoemaker is doing, and after a while, you can open your own shoemaking or shoe-repairing shop. The same is with science. Science is working in the same way. You have this master-apprentice model, where the master is your advisor, doctoral advisor, and you are all apprentices. Some of you know more than the others, have different experiences, but still, hopefully, you are learning a lot from your advisor. If you are not learning from your advisor, you feel you know more, then change your advisor, I guess I would say, because you have to learn a lot. And I bet, I suspect you are all learning from your advisors. It's a common thing. And you will notice that that model is really, in science, it's quite well known. Great scientists produce great new scientists. Here is just, I took it from Wikipedia, here is a tree of topologists, all of them quite well known, and you can, from the last one, you can look at the entire tree. Who trained them? So in science, it is done. In fact, I remember there was once an attempt. I don't know if it's still alive. There was an attempt to create a scientific genealogy. I remember I have put my name there, reporting who are my advisors, whom I learned from. The same is for chess players. Famous chess players usually learn from other very good chess players. In sports, if you look at who is training our football team, soccer team, who is training our skiers, etc., they are all people who have already been there, who know it. You can start a tradition of having excellent hockey players on your own, but it's going to be very difficult. It's much, much easier if you have a trainer who has been there, who has done it already, who knows things. Other disciplines. Here is physics. Chadwick was a student of Rutherford, and he was a student of Thomson. Each one of them has made important discoveries. They learn from them, from each other. Three generations. Here is what they write in the Wikipedia article about Vladimir Horowitz. They say who were his his teachers, but then his students. And it's interesting, showing you that science is a very social thing, like any other discipline. He had, I don't want to read it now, I think he had five students, but he claims he had only four. I guess he didn't like that the last one. That happens also in science. A student that didn't live up to his expectations. In any case, genealogy. So, as I said, you will learn probably more than you would like to learn from your advisor. But there are many things that you should learn from your advisor. And what you will learn depends on, of course, knowledge of the advisor, how good of a scientist he or she is, but also on the ability of the advisor to transfer that knowledge. And your openness, you should, you know, like a child looking at the parent, you should look at what the advisor is doing to learn as much as you can. Sometimes, of course, it happens that the advisor is unable to transfer the knowledge, the mastery. And sometimes, of course, there are advisors from hell. There's a short movie. I don't want to put it. There is a movie. It's really a Japanese comedy where a master is training his disciple and really teasing him and belittling him. You don't want to have an advisor like this. So an advisor is a very important person for you because you will learn from him or her. But sometimes the advisor will not tell you everything just because he or she will forget it. Or maybe the advisor is not that good at transferring knowledge. So you have to keep your eyes open. And the idea of such a course comes from my years as a young faculty. There was a similar course meeting once a month for a whole Saturday where people would talk about different skills of scientists. I love that, and when we were reforming our doctoral program at the University of Pittsburgh, we decided to have a course like this. And it's been working very nicely, so I'm happy to report that that my idea to have a similar course in our doctoral program was received with understanding, and they actually let me teach this course. So what this course is doing is essentially filling the different gaps that you, individual, each one of you may have in interactions with your advisor. It's making it systematic. What kind of things should you learn before you become a scientist? And that's really the topic of this course. What kind of things you should learn? Just to show you my kind of in immediate genealogy, these are the types of relationships that you build for life. I really think very warmly about every one of them on my list, and whenever I can, I try to visit them and pay my respect. Some of them are already dead, which is really regretful. I sometimes think about them, say a prayer or do something for them. Who were they? I had an advisor at the Warsaw University of Technology. Last time I contacted him was, 5 years ago or so. He moved out of Poland to Canada, to Memorial University of Newfoundland. I think he's still there or maybe retired. This is the first time I had a contact with an advisor. This was my master's studies in Poland. Then I moved to the Netherlands, where I had another advisor, Willem van der Poel. As far as I know, he's still alive, aged probably quite well. He was a chemist, became a computer scientist, quite well known in the development of computer science languages, ALGOL 68, and in general, a very, very interesting person. That's the second time in my life where I thought, wow, I want to be like that guy. Then Ad van der Hoor died a few years ago. He was my advisor in electrical engineering. New things. He studied in US. I found him very, very interesting, very enthusiastic. Learned a lot of tricks in teaching, in guiding students from him before I went on to do my doctorate. My advisor in my doctorate, Max Henyon. Whenever I'm in California, he's in California now, I try to see him. He used to invite me for dinner, I invite him now. At some point, children should invite the parents, not the other way around. Indira Nair was a general advisor in my department. I really have very warm feelings about her. She was a physicist, very nice and committed woman, a teacher. Baruch Fischhoff, a psychologist, he was in my... Where is Baruch Fischhoff? Herb Simon. I was most impressed by him. Of course, I learned a lot of things from each one of them. Working four disciplines, he became famous in every one of them. sociology, theory of organizations, that was the sociology part. Then he worked in computer science. He discovered a computer in 1960s, did a lot of interesting things. Then he was one of the people who created AI. There were two camps in US that in the world that created AI, MIT with Marvin Minsky and colleagues, and then Simon and his doctoral student, Alan Newell, created another approach to artificial intelligence. Then he became famous in psychology because he used computers to model humans. And he got, in 1977 or 78, Nobel Prize in economics. Four disciplines. He is famous in all four of them. Unfortunately, he died in 2001. I will mention him a few times in this course because I learned a lot of things, a lot of tricks from him also. Granger Morgan was the department chair. I also learned a lot from him. Baruch Fischhoff was a psychologist in my PhD committee. Also, several nice things. I will mention them and attribute to him when I talk about them. So as you see, genealogy. Clark Glimmer, I worked with him for a semester after I got my PhD. A philosopher, computational philosopher, very interesting fellow too. I learned a few things from him. Finally, one of the last mentors, he died a few years ago, Adolf Grunbaum, a philosopher of science. Very interesting fellow. I will definitely mention him a few times. Why am I showing that? Just to show you that there are always people that you learn from. And a lot of things that you will hear from me, they are not coming from me, from my brain. I just learned that. I couldn't possibly say the things that are wise, I think, and have invented them myself. You know, I learned them. Another thing I wanted to say in this context is that you should never feel restricted to your advisor. You should always look out for other people. If you find somebody impressive because you took a class from him or her, go and talk to them. Talk to other people in conferences. Get to know people because you will learn most from people. Of course, you can learn from books, but you will learn faster from people. They don't have to be scientists. They don't have to be at the university. They can be anywhere. But we learn from people. So now, what is it that we are going to do in this seminar? Again, just your presence is enough. Of course, I hope that I will speak in a way that that makes you not fall asleep, there are some things that are interesting. I will tell you a little bit about the working of science and duties of an academic. When you are a scientist, when you are already graduated with your PhD, what kind of life will you have? What kind of things will you be doing? What things you should know? Then the skills that are fundamental to working in a US scientific environment. That's where I learned that. But today, science is so global that I believe that these skills will be useful to you anywhere in the world. I'm open to hearing about other skills, but I believe that the skills I'm going to talk about are universal enough to cover probably most of what you need to know. So in any environment, you should be fine if you learn that. The benefits, I like to think about it in the following way. You see, there's these two guys having a wheelbarrow, but with square wheels, and there is somebody telling them, look, you can do it better. No, thanks, we are too busy to actually adopt that thing. I think it's sometimes worth pausing and stopping and asking yourself, am I doing things the best I could do? And in this seminar, I'm not saying that these are the best you can do, but if in every meeting that we have, there are going to be 10 meetings, if there is one or two good ideas that you will find, oh, wow, that's interesting, and you adopt them, I think that you will feel the benefit of that. One or two ideas are enough because a lot of things that I'm going to talk about, you probably know or you felt, you already have some experience. So it's not that everything that I'm going to talk about is completely new. But if there is something new, and if you adopt it, I think it will be beneficial to you. So an overview of the skills that you should master to be successful. Starting from next week, we are going to dive into each of the skills in depth. But today, just a brief overview of what we are going to do. Here is the list. And how did the list come about? So at some point when I created my first lab, I had a handful of students. I think I had 5 or 6 doctoral students at that time. I thought, why don't we organize the lab better and make sure that the students know what they are supposed to learn? So I sat down, you know, thought about this over a period of some time. So it's not that I did it in one session. No, I kind of edited, thought about that. And I came up with 18 different skills. I'll tell you why this picture later. Not at the moment, but here are the skills. Not a very even number, 18, right? Usually we have 10 most important things. 7, 3, 10, 100, right? But 100, what do they call it? 100 changes for 100 days, you know. People love those round numbers. I have 18. Very modest. If you think of a 19th one, please let me know. I'll be happy to see how that relates to the 18 I have here, and possibly change that. So now let's look at each of them just very, very briefly, because we are not going to get into them. When I was teaching this course in Pittsburgh, we had, I think we had 15 meetings, 15 or 16 meetings over the course of a semester, so I had more time. So for this seminar, I had to pick 9, because the 10th one is today's meeting, which we will not talk about anything in depth. So I had to pick what I thought were the most important. And these are, I think, that the ones that I picked, 3, 6, more than 9. But some of them will be condensed into one meeting because they relate to one thing. So how does science work? And what is research? So that's a very good question, I think. How does it work? I remember it took me a little bit of time, and when I look at my sons, when they were teenagers, we had, of course, some discussions and disagreements at the dinner table. Teenagers, boys, tend to really sometimes have it at odds with parents, and when I said something, they would strongly argue with me that my statement was unscientific. And they would present something, you know, their view as very scientific, which, of course, I would disagree with them very strongly. Then I realized that maybe this is the way I thought as a teenager myself. Belief in that science, this perfect discipline where everything is clean, beautiful, everything is truth, and everything is just so nice. If you believe that, I ask you to reconsider, to kind of look at the reality of that. There is no central authority like God up there. If you want to know something for sure, you say, God, tell me what it is, and the God tells you, oh, it's there, right? Or it's this. There's nothing like this. So if I make a statement, I'm a scientist, how do we know that what I say is true? Well, science is a very social discipline. And judging my statements belongs to other scientists, reviewers, my doctoral advisor, reviewers, other faculty members, other people will decide, am I right or not? Now, what does this tell you? Well, it's very social, right? If they dislike me, for example, they may not like my work, even though my work is good. Another thing is that even if I'm very right, I'm absolutely right, I know I'm right, I feel it somewhere deep inside, my papers can be rejected. Why? Well, because they didn't understand what I wrote. They didn't understand, they didn't like. In fact, there are examples of of works that could not be published because nobody would accept them. There are examples of theories that would hang around for a while without wide acceptance. Even such a theory as a theory of relativity by Einstein, it had a hard time being accepted. In fact, in 1933, I think, there was a book published in Germany called 100 Authors Against Einstein. That was long after he published his work already. As far as from the Wikipedia article, I learned that there was probably no anti-Semitism involved. Like, it's not because he was Jewish that they didn't like his work. There were, among the 100, there were other Jewish scientists and celebrities, right? You know, the all kinds of people who think they know that they can say something useful. Reminds me a joke from Benny Hill show. Do you know what Benny Hill show is?
Yeah.
Oh, well, wonderful that it's still popular. He had a very nice joke. What can you say about men who are bald from the front? They are thinkers. What can you say about men who are bald from the back? They are good lovers. Many of his jokes had sexual tint. What can you say about men who are bald from the back, from the front, and from the back? They think they are good lovers. It's a good joke, you know, because I like the joke because it tells you about, again, social character of many things. The 100 authors thought they knew it better than Einstein. Einstein, of course, was right. Still is right, even though he's dead. When Einstein learned about that book, by the way, he said, okay, I understand that they have the right to express themselves, but why 100? If I were wrong, one would have been enough. That's also part of science. You see, if you... other people judge if you are right or wrong, but in some disciplines, luckily, physics, mathematics, other hard sciences, even softer sciences, psychology, sociology, you can actually, even if they don't like you, if they disagree with you, you can show them evidence, empirical evidence or other evidence, that you are right. So, social character of science, that's one thing that is very kind of hard to grasp in the beginning. I assume you are already beyond that, but I wanted to make you aware, maybe when you have teenage children, to how to talk to them. No central authority. Science has to self-organize itself. It's almost like the Polish judicial system. Judges have to self-organize themselves. Right? I'm being a little ironic here, but science is like that a little bit. Other scientists decide whether you're right or wrong. The rules of the game, you need to understand them. So in science, there are three important mechanisms. We will talk about that, of course, in more depth, and some of these mechanisms will form entire meetings. Let's see. Communicating the results, that's one thing. How do you communicate your results? We'll talk about it a little bit more, but writing papers, presenting, in a seminar, that's communication. Reviewing is another mechanism. It's other people, very often anonymously, judging your work. Why anonymously? Because then they feel they can be honest. They can say critical things without being afraid that you will not like them afterwards. Sometimes it's not anonymous. Your doctors are going to be judged by probably three reviewers. You will know who they are. Sometimes it's not anonymous. In master's thesis that you did, they were not anonymous. There was a reviewer who told you what he or she thought about your work. So reviewing is the second mechanism. The third mechanism is money. Money is, you will be surprised what you can do with money as a scientist. You can buy computers. You can have money to go to conferences. You can pay your doctoral students. Pay a programmer in your lab, etc. You can do a lot of things. So this is the third mechanism, the money. flow of money. And you need to understand them. Communicating, very, very important. You need to learn how to communicate, because if you don't know how to communicate, people will not know about your work. So very, very important. It's an important skill. We will talk about that. Reviewing, another thing. You need to understand how it works. You need to start feeling how the reviewers will feel about your work when they read it. You need to anticipate their thoughts. You need to write well so that you increase the chances of that they judge your work as worthy. Money, writing grant proposals, getting money. It's also writing, very important skill, although slightly different than writing a publication. So getting money. These are the three important skills that work everywhere similarly. So we will talk about it next week. This is the topic of our meeting. I will send you links to a movie. I think it's about an hour long. I do want you to watch it. Last time I looked was on YouTube. So if it's still there, I'll send you the links. If not, I'll find another way of making it available. The reason why I'm not sure if it's on YouTube is because there are some copyright issues. Sometimes they take them down, and sometimes somebody else puts it back again. But it's a very nice movie about a real scientific discovery in physics that ended with a Nobel Prize. A Nobel Prize was given in 1990s. When I first watched that movie, they didn't get Nobel Prize yet, but then a few years later they got Nobel. You will see the mechanisms. They talk about a lot of things. You see doctoral students in their lab. You see issue of money. You see where scientists are working, different types of environments. And very interesting start to talk about how science works. This is, I think, a critical skill that makes a difference between a successful scientist, successful in the sense of having a lot of papers, scientists give money, invite to talks, give prizes, know about that scientist, and a scientist who is, you know, finished a doctorate and then got a position somewhere and then worked until retirement, published some papers, but not a very, very well-known scientist. Very important skill, finding research topics. So far, probably you were given topics. When you were doing your master's thesis, probably your advisor suggested a topic. When you were picking your doctorate position in your doctoral studies, you probably looked at different topics and picked one. Maybe you discussed it with your future advisor. So far, you may not have that much experience with finding new topics. But it's a very important skill, because the moment you have your doctorate, you will have to find new topics. And a good topic is 80% of success. In another dimension, of course, success is 95%, 5% inspiration and 95% perspiration. You have to work hard. But finding the topic is... in another dimension, it's a very, very important thing. Because you can have a boring topic and you can have a very attractive topic that everybody will want to read. So I will share with you some heuristics that I learned, in this case, from Herb Simon. He was talking about that, finding topics. How do you do that? And I found his approach very, very interesting. So I may say things that you've never heard before, some other things you may have heard many times, and this is just one way of doing this. I want to be modest in this sense. I'm not telling you the way, remember. I'm telling you one of the ways, one of the many ways. Because there are many, many ways. There are many ways to become a saint, for example. Right? Some people did it because they were caring for the poor. Others were just praying. There's a famous Lebanese saint, Saint Charbel. He was just a modest monk, very, very famous, people revere him. Many ways to become a saint, many ways to become a scientist, many ways of finding topics. I'm just going to tell you one way that I found, I heard from one of the mentors, and I liked a lot. Consider it. You don't have to follow it, but look at it, and maybe some ideas are going to be useful here. The same with martial arts. When you train, they tell you how to do it, how to hold a katana, right? How to make a step forward. But you can develop your own style after a while. But first, you learn from your master, and then you improve it. Writing papers, very, very important. They say, publish or perish. Publish or disappear. If you don't publish, you disappear. People don't see you, don't know about you. So this is a very, very important thing. You need to write. In fact, I don't know what the formal requirements are in the school, but you know that you should publish. Isn't there something like they expect you to publish 2-3 papers during your studies, something like that? There's definitely, if not written, then unwritten expectation, which is very reasonable. I think a dissertation, I would think 2-3 strong papers is a good equivalent of a dissertation. You need to learn to write because the effort that you take in good writing and poor writing is similar, not much difference. But it makes a big difference in acceptance. The reviewers will understand what you mean. They will like your paper more if you write well. So you need to write well. A few people are born writers. We have to learn it. I remember one of my doctoral students, he was a Taiwanese student. In one of the meetings, he tells me, well, I want to write better because everybody is telling me that I write poorly. So I told him, why don't you write for every meeting that we have once a week, why don't you write a page on what you read, right? What you read. He did that for a year or so. Interestingly, later on, people in the lab were asking him to read and comment on their papers. It's a very nice thing to see. He did it. I didn't, maybe I commented on his writing. One page I could look at it in the meeting. But doing, learning, and he learned, he could learn. Presentation. This is the least expensive, the cheapest, the most effective way of selling your work. Selling in quotes, of course. Like making it known, making it popular. Because it doesn't cost you much. You don't need to spend hours and hours on writing. You just prepare your presentation, some PowerPoint or something, slides, and then present it in front of the audience. But as you know, you must have seen already good and bad speakers. If not, then think about good and bad teachers. You see a teacher, you sit in the audience and say, well, oh, wow, boy, this guy or this gal is equivalent of guy for women, he cannot teach, you know, such a poor, he cannot explain things, right? So you've seen that. You've seen also good teachers who explained it in such a way that you get it right away. So being a good speaker is very important. I've noticed it quite fast. Still when I was doing my master's work, Professor van der Hoor took us once to a conference in Italy. I was in the Netherlands, we went to Italy by his car. I had a chance to see, I don't know, 20, 30 different speakers and make a judgment. I've seen poor speakers and I've seen good speakers. Good speakers, you kind of unconsciously think, wow, they must be doing very good work if they are so enthusiastic and so clear about what they are doing. You saw the masters cutting the radishes so precisely. You see the Horowitz moving the fingers so just lightly, so precisely. People who know how to do something they don't find it very difficult to talk about this clearly and enthusiastically. So an important skill. What I will offer you here is, again, a collection of advice how to make your presentations better. That's going to be the topic of the meeting. And also, definitely, we'll encourage you to talk as much as you can. Every opportunity that you can find of speaking, just volunteer and speak if you can. Because the first 5, maybe 10, you will feel a little bit not sure, not secure, but when you do it for the 20th or 30th time, it's going to be very easy, very, very easy. And that's where you want to be. Getting funding. I don't think we have a meeting on that. We had to give up on some of the topics, but that's also an important skill. they expect you to know how to get money. In fact, I know that when you want to become a full professor in Poland, they want you to have some grants, some projects. In US, depends on the university, but also I think that's also the expectation. It's amazing what you can do with money, and your dean, your, you know, the chancellor, they also know it. The more money you bring, the better for the university. So they really want you to know how to write grants and to bring money. More money, as I said, you can pay your doctoral students, you can have a bigger lab, better equipment, you can travel to conferences, make yourself more famous and your students by traveling, attract better students because they see that this advisor sends the students to conferences, and it's just better type of life. Reviewing, again, I don't think we have a special meeting on that, but it's an important skill. I'll definitely mention some things about reviewing when we talk about writing, about other things. When will you review? It may still sound abstract to you, but believe me, the moment you start publishing, the moment you send 1, 2, 3 papers, you will get invitations, an email saying, "Well, Mr., Mrs., Doctor, we have this paper. Would you please review it for us?" So very soon you will be part of the reviewing circle. You will also be reviewing things. If not that, then your advisor sometimes may be a member of a program committee of a conference, and he or she will give you a paper. Would you please review this? What should be your reaction be? What should your action be? Sure. When do you want to have it? Next week? Fine, right? So don't lose that opportunity, because you will review it, discuss it with your advisor before sending the review, but it's an opportunity to learn how to do it. It's also a good... you learn a lot from that. I don't even mean you get early access to information, which, by the way, is creates an ethical a temptation. Of course, ethical behavior is to forget what you read so that you don't consciously or unconsciously steal the ideas from the paper that has never been published yet. I don't even mean that. I mean getting experience in what is a good writing, what is a poor writing. When you read the paper, you see, oh, I would have done it better. Or this was really nice that the author did. I remember when I was a young faculty, a critical thing for me was that when I took part in a review panel at a major funding agency in US, National Science Foundation, they invited me to take part in a review panel. And that was an enlightening experience. I saw how decisions are being made there. That helped me so much in writing proposals. So much, really, very valuable. So it's also something that gives you benefits, but it's mainly it's a duty. You should do it to benefit science. Teaching, some of you may choose a different career, going to an industrial research center, starting a company, or become a politician. We have people with doctorates who are politicians. Kosiniak-Kamysz has a doctorate. Pawlak, I think, he's no longer in politics, but he had a doctorate, and others also. So you can choose different careers, but many of you will end up in a university where you have to teach, where you will have your own doctoral students. Well, own in quotes, of course. Nobody owns anybody these days, slavery, where you will have to teach them. Yes, so some fundamental things you need to learn how to do it. And you've been learning it all the years that you were at school, at the university. You've seen good and bad teachers. That taught you something already. But there are also other skills that are, other tricks that I learned really later, much later, in a systematic way. Teaching is also good because of many things. There is a couple of books that I absolutely recommend to you. It's Richard Feynman,
The first book is Surely You Are Joking, Mr. Feynman. The title is because they offered him tea and asked, do you want lemon or milk? And he said, I'll take both. And the lady, who was very distinguished, said, surely you are joking, Mr. Feynman. You don't take both, because of course the milk will spoil. In any case, the books are really about him being a scientist. The subtitle is Adventures of a Curious Character. The books are translated into Polish, if you prefer reading it in Polish. Absolutely delightful. And there is a chapter on titled I Couldn't Live Without Teaching, I think, where he argues why teaching is a great idea. One thing he says is there are two reasons for that, but that he cannot live without teaching. One is that he says the scientist sometimes feels like he or she is flying, you know, a lot of ideas, many papers published, you know, invited talks, etc. And then there are much longer periods where you have no ideas, when you are in between something, and you feel not productive. He says, teaching in those periods makes me feel useful. Otherwise, I would feel completely useless. The second argument he gives is that teaching is a source of inspiration. Students in classes that you teach sometimes ask naive questions. You might say, you might feel tempted to say maybe silly questions. He says, no, there are no naive questions, no silly questions in classroom environment. Those questions prompt you, tell you that you didn't explain something well, or give you ideas for research. In fact, Feynman diagrams, these are diagrams that he developed for teaching physics. I think he said that the ideas came when he was teaching a class in physics. So it's a source of inspiration. He gives example where people had everything. They had the money, they had computers, buildings, everything, but they were isolated from others, from the world, and they produced nothing. I think there was some think tank in Princeton somewhere. He says they produced nothing. Maybe he's exaggerating, but he's saying that. Because they were isolated in secrecy and they had no connection with others. So teaching is important, and if you are doing something, you should do it well. Why would you do anything if you are not doing it well? Guiding students, running a lab, I think we will have a meeting on that. Managing projects. In a few years from now, you will have it. When you finish your doctorate, you will, if you work at a university, you will be guiding master's and bachelor's students. That's already beginning of a lab. Once you get the Doctor of Science, because what you are doing is Doctor of Philosophy, Doctor of Science is called in Polish habilitacja. It's another degree. It doesn't exist in every country, but in England it's, I think, called Doctor of Science. If you have that, you can guide doctoral students. So then you will have a lab very quickly. So they don't teach you how to do it. When I was starting, I kind of did what I thought was right, but nobody told me how to do it. It's a good idea to learn, to be a manager and a leader at the same time. Creativity is very useful in science, especially in finding problems and in addressing them. Sometimes it takes just a little bit to do something very creative. And it turns out that creativity is not something that you are born with. Some people think they are born not creative. I remember there was a woman I knew, a Chinese woman, and she would say many wise things, but she would also say stupid things, like every one of us, right? One of the most stupid, maybe the most stupid thing she said, is she said, we Chinese are not very creative. That's stupid, really stupid. Because creativity, it turns out, maybe it's cultural, maybe in her training, she wasn't taught to be creative. That may be true for the education in the Far East, but in the West we are taught a little bit of that. But there's more that you can do. Every one of us can become more creative by simple tricks, simple things that you need to pay more attention to. So I have a presentation on creativity, and hopefully it's going to be interesting to you. Wouldn't all of us want to become more creative? That doesn't deserve a meeting. When I started my work as a scientist, we used to do library work, go to the library. These days, you do everything on search engines, and you can find everything that you want. Not worth spending a whole class. Maybe there is going to be need to mention this or that in here. That's an important topic. In fact, we are going to talk about it not too late in the semester. So we're going to have a meeting on career planning. That's a really important thing. There is the this is a quote from a cartoon, a movie. I think it was called in Poland Yogi Bear and Yogi and Bubu. What was the American name for that?
It's a phrase from Yogi Bear.
Oh, you know the Yogi Bear. Yeah. So Bubu is asking Yogi. That was the Polish name of the little bear. Where are you going? Well, I don't know. How will you know that you get there if you don't know where you are going, right? It's a good idea to do a little bit of thinking. The thinking doesn't have to be precise. It's not like, I'm thinking I'm going to be in the department of software engineering in Warsaw University of Technology, and I'm going to be a professor there. That's a very precise planning. I would advise against that because with this kind of precision, it's so easy to change the path. But you may have maybe less precise, but also very, very strong, very well-defined goal. What you want to do, and what goal should you choose? What should you do? Here, I'm basing that presentation on something that I learned from a guy that I wasn't. It's not. He's not in the tree because I just heard him once. I talked to him after the lecture. I have a recording of that lecture, with full permission. If you want to, I'll send. Not if you want. I'll send you a link because the presentation is not clear enough. He speaks English, American English, but not very clearly, and the recording is not that great. So maybe with headphones you can follow him. And then I will review the most important things from what he said. A lot of good advice, plus some other things that I learned also. So long-term planning, good idea. This doesn't deserve a separate meeting, but it's also a skill that you absolutely have to learn. It's essentially creating a network. And it's easy to be misunderstood here, especially in Poland, where Poland may be not the worst, but there are networks in Poland that I would call, in Polish, kolesie. Oczywiście, there must be also a female equivalent of that, kolesiówy, nie wiem jak to nazwać. I don't know what to say that. It's, in English I would say something like, buddies. Old boys network. That's the negative thing. Old boys network where women are not welcome and we kind of arrange things ourselves. Like that's the connotation
the
here.
Cave.
Pardon?
The men's
cave. Yes, but it's broader. You see, the kolesiowanie, there can be female there also, and in fact there are also. So there is more of that in Poland, but Poland is not the worst country. I mean, there are other countries where it's even worse, you can imagine. But a lot of things here in Poland happen in this kind of networks, among politicians, among, in the media, in universities also. A lot of kind of not completely clean tricks, like I've heard about increasing the number of citations, but I will cite you, you will cite me, And that's absolutely unethical practice. And when I say about building a network, I don't mean that absolutely. I absolutely don't mean that. It's really building a network in a very positive sense. Network that you can use, that can be useful for your career. In what way can it be useful? Suppose I want to know, I'm getting into forestry, right? Because I, you know, I have a, somebody asked me to do something. Forests, I don't know anything about this. What do I do? Oh, Robert. I still have his email address, right? Phone number. Robert, can you point me to a couple of review papers that will get me into this area, right? Is there anything unethical about this? Absolutely not. It's essentially having a colleague, a friend or a colleague, whom you can ask things. I want to get a job, and there is an advertisement from, say, Warsaw University of Technology, Department of Computer Science. I want to get that job. And they described, we are looking for somebody who has this and this area and da 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 da. Okay, I learn it, I see it. But the question is, what are they really looking for? I know this lady who was my student, who is now working there. Huh? Can you tell me who you are really looking for, what kind of teaching skills and research skills you need? And there's a very good chance that my colleague will know more, right? Or you are looking for a position for your student. You do that. I hope your advisors will do that too. When there's an opening, they will help you in that way because they have colleagues, friends in different places. They just ask. Not unethical information, because the other person should keep an eye on unethical insider's information, but that person will tell you whatever he or she can tell you, right? But it will be definitely more than you learn. You are organizing a conference, and you are trying to put together a program committee. Okay, I have this. Whom should I put in this area? Well, I met this lady in a conference 3 years ago, and I had a very nice chat with her. Maybe I can ask her. And I still have her email, of course, right? We exchanged emails or business cards. We sent her email and said, well, I still think about the nice chat we have 3 years ago at the conference, and I'm organizing a conference now, and I thought you would be an excellent person to serve on the committee for this field. Would you please join the committee? She's very busy, but how can she refuse me, right? That's the idea of the network. You see, I mean absolutely ethical things. The more people you know, the better. I'm writing a new paper, and very few people around me know this field. And those who do, I already asked to read my paper. But I met this interesting guy last year at the conference. Maybe I can ask him to do a friendly review for me, right? Or I'm going to Wrocław on vacation, right, or something. And why don't I visit Krzysztof, who is working there, right? I'm sending an email to Krzysztof and saying I'm going to be around. What does Krzysztof answer? Wonderful. Why don't you come and visit us and tell something about your work? And what is your answer? I'll be delighted to come. Right? That's what the networks are for. And nothing unethical, again, but a lot of connections, sources of information, sources of all kinds of ties. Another thing, you are looking for a job, and this guy will tell about this when he talks about career planning. When he was applying for a job, then the future employer, the director of the institute, NIH, what does he do? He picks a phone and calls his colleagues. Have you heard about Kenneth Olden? That's his name. Have you heard about him? If he calls five people and five people say, Kenneth Olden, I never heard of him. What does he do? Well, let's look at the next candidate, right? So the more people know you, the more people have heard your name, the more people you have talked with, the better. What do you do at conferences when there is a coffee break or a lunch break? You queue up for coffee and you say to the person in front of you, hi, I'm from Białystok University of Technology. Where are you from? What are you doing? Right? And that person should tell you in half a minute what he or she is doing. You tell what she's doing. And then if there is any connection, you just talk more. That's how you meet people. Lunch break. You sit at preferably at tables where you don't know anybody. If you are shy, then try to kind of break that shyness and do that. So that's what networking is about. We are not going to talk about this. It doesn't deserve a whole meeting, but it's going to be mentioned in many places. A very important skill. Being part of the social structures of science. Because it's social. Yes?
I have to leave. Can I go?
Yes, sure. You can go. You can come and go whenever you want. If you miss something, I'll try to record. If you see that I forgot setting it up, please remind me so I can turn on the recording. Okay. Marketing your skills, job hunt. I forgot if I have a presentation on that. I definitely have a presentation on that, but. I'm not sure if it's part of this course, but I definitely will be very happy to tell you more about this. Job hunt in Poland is somewhat different than in US or in many places that I know. The reason for that is that very often, especially in computer science, there are very few candidates. So that when they find somebody, they really want that person. So they write the advertisement. Precisely, we want to have a person who finished this department, wears glasses and has a beard and a mustache, almost, you know, like, you know, which is very different than I've seen that in US, where they really are interested in getting the best candidates, absolutely the best. There, of course, you have to know how to get a position. Just to give you an idea of the competition sometimes, when I finished my PhD, I couldn't leave Pittsburgh because of family reasons. The national average at good universities was 150 applicants per one position. It was hopeless. And there was one opening in Pittsburgh, and another one was not, I wasn't really fitting well. I had to get that. And I did it the Japanese way. You know the Japanese way? This anecdote illustrating that. Archer, like in the movies, the martial art movies, standing in front of the goal, you know, the shield, and holding one arrow in the bow and another arrow holding with his left hand with the bow. And there is the master who comes to him and with his bow slashes him through the head and says, "You idiot, you novice, never hold a second arrow when you are using the first, because you will trust your second arrow and you will let the first arrow go lightheartedly." That's the Japanese way. You do things in such a way that you cannot fail. At least you try not to fail. I got that position, but it was really miraculous. Anyway, so a lot of things, but I did a lot of things then, a lot of things, trial talks and opinion of other people, and a lot of things. I couldn't sleep in the morning that day of my interview, so I looked back 15 or so years earlier when I did yoga and I did some relaxation exercises. Even that. But there are things that are much easier than that everybody should know. But if you are looking for jobs elsewhere, like in Poland also, there are real places where there is competition. And if you look for jobs anywhere outside, you will need these skills. So we can talk about them. This is an important thing, really. We don't have it as a separate thing, but it can be combined with time management. How do you manage to do everything as a scientist? There are a lot of pressures because you have to work hard. I'll mention that as we go, working hard. What does it mean for a scientist? There's definitely a period in your life, like it is now in your life, where you have to work about 80 hours a week. And you think, wow, boy, I cannot do that, right? But 80 hours, I'm including the time when you are walking to work or riding your bicycle or taking shower, vacuum cleaning, and you are still thinking about your problems. That also counts. But typically, you need about 80 hours a week working very hard for a number of years as a scientist. So how do you find time for that? Not very easy. Especially given that family life is much more important than your career and scientific career. So how do you find the balance between the two? And that takes actually a lot of effort. If you think that scientists don't divorce, don't have broken families, then you are wrong. Maybe the rate of divorce in Poland is not very high, but when I look at my acquaintances in US, for example, in other countries, in the Western Europe, scientists are really not much more resistant to that than other professions. So you have to absolutely take conscious efforts to find time for the really most important things in your life, which is family, but at the same time, find enough time to develop your career. And everybody has the need for the family, of course. That's a dogma almost. But another thing is, of course, for realizing yourself in some professional way. You want to leave this world thinking, I've done something useful. In addition, of course, to creating a family and having children, I want to have a feeling that I've done something useful for other people also. And that's our career, the professional life. So finding the balance, organizing time, that's a skill. I'm not sure if I'm the best person to teach you about that, but I can share with you some of the things that definitely helped me with that. Stress, that's the same, very similar thing, of course, stress. The amount of work, stress, how do you remain sane? Ethics, that's going to be our last meeting, and ethics can be taught in many ways. It can be taught in a very boring way, of course, telling the rules. You know most of the rules, probably. You know when you see something or when you are about to do something, you probably have a feeling deep inside you whether this thing is ethical or not. We all have it. But what I'm going to talk about is something else, I think. It's the main theme there is the obligation that we have by being scientists, having doctorate, that carries obligation. And so that's mainly about that and what obligations are there. So, in addition to the typical ethical situations where you need to be more watchful. These are the texts, by the way, in Polish. These are taken from the rules, and the rules are very very nice. Where the ethics of a doctorate, it's a very honorable title. In United States, for example, this is the terminal degree. There is nothing more above that. So doctor is a very honorable title. Professor is just your function at the university. So being doctors, you have to keep more straight, you know, and I'm not saying being too proud. There are two words for being proud in Polish, by the way. In English, there's just word pride, proud. But in Polish, there is duma and... No. I mean the nouns. Duma and when... Pycha, yes, very good. Pycha is too much pride. Duma is just right. You have to be proud of the fact that you are a human being, for example, right? That's a reason to be proud. But pycha is too much pride, which is... there's no separate word for English. I remember, I paid attention to that, there is a book by Karolina Lanskorońska, a Countess Karolina Landskrońska about her life experiences during the Second World War. I absolutely recommend that book. There's an English translation also, very, very late translation. She couldn't publish that book right after the war because it was too much anti-Russian. Years later, she couldn't publish it because it was too much anti-German. They judged the publishers. She published it only in 1990s, I think. It's not anti, she just describes her experiences. In any way, she wrote there, her observation was that Germans have too much picha and too little pride.
Dumy.
Tak. Very interesting observation, I would say that, very interesting. Anyway, ethics. And that doesn't deserve a separate meeting, but it's something that everyone has to learn. Appreciation for quality, not quantity. There's all kinds of point systems, like in Poland, they encourage you to publish many papers because you need to collect points. Baruch Fischhoff, one of the people, told me once, the society expects from us small number of high quality publications, not large number of mediocre publications. I think it was very, very wise what he said. I absolutely believe that. One publication can make you world famous. 100 publications that are... nobody will know about you. So the quality, in whatever you are doing, aim high and do things well. Reviewing, writing, presentation, do that well. But that's not a separate meeting. That's just something that I want to pay your attention to. We are approaching the end of time. I just wanted to show you a joke that is a part of a comedy, American comedy by Mel Brooks. Maybe you'll like it. I'm afraid we'll exhaust my time.
Moses went to the mountain.
Moses, this is the Lord thy God commanding you to obey my law. Do you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. A deaf man can hear you.
What?
Nothing, I'm punished, and forget it. Oh, Lord, why have you chosen me? What would you have me do for you?
I shall give you my laws, and you shall take them unto the people.
Yes, Lord!
That's Mel Brooks, if you don't know.
Lord, I shall give these laws unto my people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... 10 commandments for all to obey!
That's about 10 most important things and 15 most important things. I like this joke. I hope nobody is insulted because of your religious beliefs. I think it's just a good joke. I have a few remarks that I didn't get a chance to talk about. There's just one slide I wanted to show you. The rest you can just read. This is a picture that I hope you will remember. You must have seen it. That shows you the power of compound interest. Compound interest is when you invest some amount of money, and then when it brings you interest, you reinvest it. So you keep the money in the bank. Look at that. Depending on the age when you invest, 25, 35, or 45 years, this is how much money you will have when you are 65. 65 is the age of retirement. The lesson is, invest as early as you can. As early as you can. Now, the same holds for skills. If you learn something when you are a young person, then you will use that skill for the rest of your life. The effect of that skill is going to be much higher than when you learn something late in your life. There's this saying in Polish, czego jaś się nie nauczył,
tego Jan nie będzie umiał. I'll explain it to you in a moment. What Johnny has not learned, John will not know. This is the exact translation. So that's the last picture I wanted to leave you with. The skills, whatever, as I said, if you learn one or two things in a meeting, I bet it's going to be useful if you use it. So that's the idea of this whole seminar, and making it all systematic. So thank you very much. We'll see you next week.